Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bharat Varta Weekly. Roshan is out today, and so instead of him, it's Nirav Kanodra, your host. With me, I have our regulars, Abhishek Paul and Prasanna. Hey, Prasanna. Hey, Abhishek. How are you guys doing?
All fine, all fine.
Hi, guys.
What's the latest weather in Bangalore?
I also made it to Mumbai from Singapore after like a gap of 2 years. So borders have opened. So yeah, just got a holiday. So yes, we've got a lot to cover this week. We've had the controversy of the comedian Veer Das making controversial statement taken up in the West. Delhi is in lockdown due to pollution. And the biggest story this week is the farm laws that have been repealed and more. So moving on. Last week, we had a couple of episodes. We had the election analysis for the by-elections with Rohit Jayaraman. And we had the conversation with Vikram Sood, the former head of Raw, which is also part of Alina's talks, talking about more geopolitical trends rather than more domestic things. But Abhishek, you saw the episode with Rohit Jayaraman. What thoughts on that one?
Yes, so some very interesting result in the by-elections, very well explained as usual by Rohit. So some interesting trends are emerging, but they're all a sort of mixture of both local and national consideration. So for example, the state I follow very closely, like West Bengal, BJP is getting totally decimated, right? And losing a lot of the ground they had gained over the last few years. So their vote share is down significantly. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a bit of it is based due to the sort of backlash and lack of response by the, or perceived lack of response by the central BJP to the events in West Bengal. So I think probably the morale of folk of that party are down there right now. So similarly, interesting things happening in other states as well. Like he really explained Himachal Pradesh well. A lot of local factors, candidates. For example, when a candidate who's passed away, their seat opens up, BJP's generally taking the policy of not nominating a family member or someone like that. And sometimes that doesn't work out well, right, because of sympathy factors and things like that. So very interesting.
So moving on to our first topic. So we had delivery of the S-400 air defense system. This is procurement from Russia. And this is a $15 billion payment which was made over the last 3 years. We also have Vladimir Putin's visit early next month. So Abhishek, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so good to see the work on this front progressing, you know, as per expected timelines, right? So all the five S-400 systems are expected to be completed by early 2023. And it's good to see that it is starting off. And this will definitely significantly boost, you know, India's defense capabilities as far as the Air Force is concerned, right? But the bigger sort of question here is, what will the United States do in terms of the SCATSA sanctions, right? So that's something that we have been talking about for quite some time now. The Biden administration so far has been sort of tight-lipped about this. They have not really given a simple answer in terms of whether they will be waiving it off. I think India does expect a waiver and does not expect sanctions. In terms of US internal politics, at least the Republican side has started or brought in an amendment via three senators who are basically calling for a waiver of sanctions to India, which is a Quad partner. And, you know, given the overall situation with China, etc., they believe it makes a lot of strategic sense to give India this leeway. The other sort of more technical issue is in terms of, contamination of various systems, which are either US, made and Russia made. And what are the technical implications of that? So that's a more technical concern. India has been trying to give, some assurance that all those things will be taken care of, right? And there will be no non-privileged, tech transfer or things like that. So an operational technical secrecy of different systems will be maintained properly. So that's something on a parallel track. But yeah, the bigger picture is, of course, what happens on the sanctions or otherwise. And let's see. how things develop on that.
It's quite interesting how like India was like, though on paper non-aligned, but like a Soviet ally, moving, inching towards being like a US ally and part of a Quad. And now again, coming back, like, so it's balancing all powers. Probably it buys too much defense systems, is the biggest buyer of defense equipment globally. So I think sharing the pie all around from France and US and Russia. So moving on. So Sensex and Nifty dropped 2%. It was a shortened week. On Friday, we had Guru Nanak Jayanti. And the big news this week was the Paytm IPO, which unlike all the mega IPOs, which we discussed in the previous week, like Nykaa, LatentView, this one was less subscribed, especially in the HNI segment. And that is where like a lot of HNIs were taking loans from NBFCs and parking in large amounts, expecting only a fraction of the allocations and expecting to make a quick profit flipping the IPO. This one has caught people wrong-footed. It's also to be noted that during the same week in China, Alibaba shares have collapsed a lot of their weaker projections for growth and also like higher regulatory clampdown on tech. So Paytm, which is like a similar company to Alipay and also has some Alibaba stake, was hammered on its opening day itself, down 27%. And you saw like the safe haven holding ground, like gold or like government bonds, etc. And for example, the Paytm, which is supposed to disrupt the PSU bank. So Nifty PSU bank index was up. Anyways, this is probably a hiccup. The valuation of Paytm at about $20 billion was maybe a bit too high, but even at a $14-15 billion valuation, it is still a very valuable company. The company is here to stay. We had the CEO Vijay Shekhar Sharma coming up on TV and all news channels defending the company and their business model, etc. So I think this is just a little bit of the IPO mania got ahead of itself. Nothing has like changed fundamentally, but what has happened is that people got a little bit too euphoric, and these kind of like pullbacks are a healthy sign. I don't think anything has changed for like the Indian economy broadly. Paytm has a lot of competition from Google Pay, from Phone Pay, and other payment apps, right? So I think it's going to be a part of an ecosystem. Maybe if it is a bit overvalued, that should correct itself. And hopefully markets recover next week after the long holiday. Prasanna, any further thoughts on this? Or?
Oh, I think some of the Paytm's troubles were rather well known, right, actually. So especially I think it's a very crowded payment landscape right now, and I'm not sure whether Paytm of course it had a very distinct early advantage when it was purely the wallets, right, but subsequently with the UPI enabled payment system, I think even that edge has been lost, and they're not even the market leaders. And then there are so many diversifications that they have made without any clear winning strategy, at least at this point of time. And expanding their footprint by either getting into the NBFC space, or even there were some reports that they might also even want to get a banking license and all that. But you know, there are so many regulatory challenges around that. So I think it's basically apprehension over the way they've been all over the place without the focus. I think that's kind of really, at this point of time, spooked a lot of serious investors, I would think. But as you said, you know, I think too early to write off. And I think like they have very deep brand identification. It's a great personal journey for the entrepreneur, I'm sure, you know, from you know, such a modest background to the kind of achievements that he scaled. I think that's of, you know, yet another example of how entrepreneurship is flourishing in the country. So that's an aspect that all of us need to celebrate. But from an organization perspective, obviously, you know, the personal story can, garner attention only that much, right? So after that, it's serious numbers and business models which come under scrutiny. So I think that's what happened. Let's see how this entire thing spawns out.
It's still a $14 billion company. Correct. So it is a massive company despite this fall. So absolutely. And it's, you know, not very wise to write off strong-willed entrepreneurs like Vijay Shekhar Sharma. I think he will bootstrap his way out and figure a way out. And hopefully it's good for the whole ecosystem. Correct. Anyways, as you were talking last week, all these IPOs are getting a bit too overheated, and investing in IPOs can be risky. So this actually is a nice way to highlight the risks involved in investing in IPOs. So
correct.
Moving on, So Delhi has gone into lockdown due to smog. The Delhi government closed schools and colleges indefinitely, implementing a work from home and halted any construction or demolition activities. According to the notice, the AQI or the air quality index has touched 471 in Delhi, beyond the safe limit, which is said to be 100. The Chief Justice also asked the central and Delhi governments to come up with an emergency plan to tackle the dangerous smog, calling the situation very serious. So Prasanna, what are your thoughts on this? And what do you see as being like a solution to like a very serious problem? This is repeating itself every year, so it's nothing new.
It's quite, I really don't know. I mean, you can dismiss some of the measures that are, you know, being implemented, like lockdowns and all that, as knee-jerk, which it is certainly. But from a long-term enduring solution perspective, I simply really don't have a solution, because if you really look at the affidavit filed by the center, pollution seems to be a combination of several things, starting from, you know, construction work to stubble burning to public transport. So, you know, it seems like a really complex, wicked, multidimensional problem, which I'm not very sure how it can be addressed. And also, I think the geographic location and the topography of Delhi itself lends to this level of pollution, you know, and that's a huge urban sprawl, you know, like you're talking about almost 30 million people living in the NCR region, right? And urbanization brings with it a certain, you know, certain way of life, which is also energy intensive. Even if you address, let's say, and Delhi is like also one of the cities which has a fairly well-developed public transportation, right? Yeah. Like it has a very sprawling metro network, and you know, so I really don't know. Like it seems a very complex problem, to be honest. Like I mean, I've really, you know, I do read a bit, but I've really not read anything that seems to be very solution oriented. Everybody has certainly an opinion based on, say, your political preference or your you know, worldview about like what is the cause of the pollution. But what is the solution? You know, whether we need to look at drastic solutions like depopulating that kind of massive urban conglomerates. But again, I don't know whether you can never reverse urbanization or, you know, do any engineered urbanization in a country like India. You know, the cities, you could always do a bit of planning, but cities evolve because they are economic engines. They are like, you know, they attract human capital. So many reasons are there. So if you really look at least going by the affidavit, when there are so many reasons, how do you prioritize and tackle? I think it's very complex, actually.
Actually, yeah, you highlighted the complexity very well. And like, last week, you shot an episode with Vaibhav Chaturvedi of the Council on Energy, Environment and Water. So that was more on COP26. And while he mentioned the difference between pollution, which is very local, and climate change or climate policy, which is very global. But he said that all these situations are complex. There are multiple things at play together in parallel. And also, there are multiple things which are more prevalent at a certain point in time during the year, right? Including weather pattern, including seasonal stubble burning, etc. And issues like different things like particulate matter or like CO2 emissions. And all of this comes in. So what is needed is probably like, these are all like applying band-aids kind of thing. But what we need is a concentrated effort on like multiple fronts. And it's a complex system. So, you know, you attack one problem from one dimension, maybe the other one becomes stronger, etc. So there are no easy answers, and hopefully everyone comes together and does work towards improving the problem from where we are. We might not be able to solve it completely, but at least take us steps in the right direction. So moving on. So coming to the big topic this week, the farm laws have been repealed. Prime Minister Modi on Friday announced that all three of the farm laws were repealed. In his address to the nation, PM stated that the laws will be repealed by the end of the month in the winter session of the parliament. And he's requested the protesting farmers to return back to their homes. He also added that 1 lakh crore has been given to farmers as compensation, and that Bima and pension has also been provided. Farm leader Rakesh Tikait tweeted that the farmers would not withdraw their agitation immediately and would continue till the farm laws are repealed in the parliament. Abhishek, what thoughts on this? This has been a very controversial bill. What do you see this form of retreat as?
Yeah, it's obviously a decision that would have taken a lot of thought and processing, and obviously some amount of courage, right? Because prima facie, it's a big loss of face for the prime minister, right? So a lot of political capital had been invested in making the case for these reforms. But as he said in his address, the explanations proved to be not good enough. The positions which the people had taken, they refused to change their positions despite listening to any or all of the explanations which were given. So, I had written a blog last year, and it's pretty difficult to, you know, do reforms in India due to various reasons, right? And some of them are pretty basic and intuitive, right? Because reforms are supposed to give you benefits over the long run, but in the short run they do impact adversely a smaller group of population. So in this case, clearly it was the Arathiya community, right, who are, let's put the middlemen, who are very influential in various fields of the life of Punjab, right? From farmers, but also up to politicians. They are into financing, and of course also the religious angle, right? So they are well entrenched in the Gurudwara ecosystems, right? So there was a lot of obviously folks whose life and business models were getting impacted by these changes, right? And they were definitely not ready to accept. So now obviously we have seen worldwide, but also in India, that over the last decade, sort of very stringent kind of protesting has come up, right? Where it's become difficult for democratically elected governments to go ahead with their mandate because people are basically coming onto the streets and stopping lives and livelihood and, you know, general business. And there is only so much a democratically elected government can do, right? You cannot be basically spraying bullets, right? Some people may want that, but that's not happening, right, in India. So, I mean, we've seen really some of the worst things were in terms of the Red Fort related thing on 26th January, right? But despite all that, I think the atmosphere had gotten very toxic. So once the ruling dispensation is seen as attacking your form of life, livelihood and identity, it became something where it became a stalemate, right? People were refusing to go back to normal life. They had basically staked their existence on this. And so I guess looking at various angles, including the sort of secessionist angle that is still there. I mean, we cannot deny it. We don't know exactly how prevalent or how big that sentiment is within India, but it definitely gets a lot of funding and support and noise from the diaspora, right? The Punjabi diaspora definitely is a big player in that part also. So yeah, Punjab and of course also Mr. Tikayat and his friends in Western UP did manage to put up a very stiff resistance, which ultimately in the national interest, the PM and the government decided that it's not worth stopping everything else, right? People's basic lives are getting impacted for a very long time, right? With all these protests and blockades and things like that. So I guess that's where it is. It's going to be interesting to see. I mean, the general concern is not just limited to these laws, but also what happens in the future. Does this form of protesting, does this tactic become a winning one for those who are opposed to the government, right? And does this stall other kind of future reforms? As Taleb often says, right, in his theory of the determined minority, right?
Yes.
Are they able to stall, or, you know, basically they prevail because their skin in the game is much more, right? So you and I, yes, may like the reform, but we are sitting at home, right? We are not,
yes, yes,
out on the street to say yay to the reforms, right? We are talking.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think this is a thing that is now a global phenomenon. And let's see. I suppose government could take a simple lesson that they'll just concentrate on regular stuff and plumbing activities, get the economy booming again for the next couple of years and not get into more contentious issues. So yeah, let's see how it goes.
Yeah. So basically, it is to be seen whether this form of like protesting against any law which you don't like, because as you mentioned about the vocal minority, even the previous chief economic advisor to the Finmin, Subramaniam, mentioned that there are like a small vocal privileged minority who are losing because of these reforms, but the benefits are far widespread. Also in Maharashtra, the Shetkari Sangathan, which is a farmer's body which was actually for the farm laws, has actually said that this is a step backward, and they've also mentioned that other laws need to be repealed, which are things like the Land Sealing Act or the Essential Commodities Act, and they actually want more reform. They said this wasn't enough, and it's sad to see this rolled back, but in a democracy, I think more debate or more consensus building or selling the narrative to wider set of audience is needed. So Prasanna, what are your thoughts on these lines?
On that fact that there was debate or lack of consensus, I think is complete. I would not dignify that line of argument much. You know, see this agri reforms, at least intellectual consensus on this agri reforms has been there almost for, I mean, as far as I remember, following economics and probably, you know, reading about what essentially constitute reforms. These are like checklist items, like, you know, in terms of what basic reforms are. Okay. There are like innumerable legislative discussions and, you know, parliamentary committees have gone through that and all. So it is basically, I mean, I this entire thing that there was no discussion, debate, and this was sprung up suddenly is just like a very politically convenient argument. And also there is this brigade of intellectuals in India who kind of keep clamoring. Actually, a set of reforms are delivered. I mean, there are certainly some, all these reforms happen within the context of a certain political economy. So they have, you always see them that, you know, no, this is not the reforms that we expected. You know, this A is missing, C is missing. So I would say like there is no, intellectually honest audience as well for reforms in India. Abhishek put it so beautifully in terms of, you know, determined minority whose livelihood is affected, you know, they are going to do that. And in this case, there was another factor is that these protesters, right, this farming elite, I think that proximity to Delhi also works, right? Like one, you have the Western UP and you have the Punjabi farmers. So it helps that they have geographic proximity to Delhi and they can do very visible protests, right? So you know, that kind of, they're able to gather a lot of attention. Let's say, you know, 500,000 farmers mobilize in Madhya Pradesh. How much will it shake the conscience of the nation vis-a-vis, say, same thing happening in Delhi, okay? So that proximity to the Delhi is also an additional factor which certainly helped them. And the last point is that, you know, if you really look at it in a very dispassionate way from a political sense, BJP is a non-entity currently in Punjab, right? Of course, they have some pockets of support in urban Punjab, but largely they are not an electorally potent force. You know, they are not in a position to mount any electoral challenge for the election. So, you know, if you're talking that these laws are basically, you know, repealed because of Punjab election, again, I mean, it defies any commonsensical political analysis. And even in Western UP, right, like when you're really talking about the election impact, see, typically, even in 2019, if you looked at the community that's closely identified with agrarian protests, the farm bill protests, the Jat community, didn't really vote in large numbers for BJP. If you really look at BJP was able to manage because they were able to mobilize so many other groups. In fact, the party which kind of typically has a good vote share among the Jat community, which is the Jain Chaudhary led RLD, it was a part of the Mahagathbandhan, and they couldn't really, of course, I think Western UP was slightly closer compared to other parts of UP in terms of the final vote share difference happened. But you know, but there is also this possibility, like what happened in Haryana by-election, since I'm sure Rohit would have spoken, that one particular seat, I think there was a counter-mobilization against Jats because of the very aggressive nature of protests farm protest that happened, you know. So you never know how it really plays out in the politics. So my suspicion is that it is not driven by any electoral consideration. I think it's essentially two factors that would have driven this repeal, which certainly represents a loss of face for the Prime Minister. One is, I would say that from a Sangh perspective, from a BJP perspective, see, unlike the traditional Hindu-Muslim relationship, right, the Sangh and the BJP puts a lot of premium on the dharmic panth unity, okay, even at the cost of this being not reciprocated. And this has been a trend, and even Mr. Modi himself, you know, you would have seen that his reverence for Sikh gurus, Sikh image, I mean, the religious imagery of the Sikhism, long predates even his tenure as chief minister, and it probably is rooted in his Sangh days as well. So there is this, so they might have made a decision that, you know, the maintaining the social harmony is much more important than, say, economics. I mean, and there is no doubt, I think Abhishek, correctly, that law is basically years of intellectual arguments and what the political parties themselves demanded, finally taking the shape of law. So, you know, this is basically, I think, deciding that, you know, social accord, not fracturing the, you know, reopening the fault lines between the Hindu and the Sikh community is very critical. I think that is one of the most critical point in the decision. This, as Abhijit briefly alluded, become very, of course, there are economic factors, but it's kind of very well intrinsically interlinked with the Gurudwara funding system, with the Khalistan diaspora involvement. So there is a very complex group of factors, okay? And so I think, you know, basically the social harmony factor would have played a big role in the Prime Minister decision. And lastly, I would also think that India's own security situation, you have a ever-expansive China around that. So when you're talking about from a national security perspective, you know, I think domestic discord, especially, I'm sure the people in the top would have a certain sense of what's likely to unfold. So my sense is that, you know, any domestic discord at this time will make us very vulnerable if in terms of an expansive, you know, any attempts by China. So I think there is a bit of a lag, like national security consideration also playing a role. So my think is that it's very little to do with Punjab or Western politics. Maybe it can help in the margins that some extent, you know, there might be, at least in Western UP and Haryana, the hostility of a section of Jat community. But I don't think so. The behavior in Punjab is fundamentally going to change. And I think BJP's Punjab problem predates Modi, and I think, like, and also the fact that, you know, Modi is seen as a symbol of a kind of a reassertive Hindutva, though his politics is seen that way in Punjab. I think that's also a factor which has played a role. So, you know, I think, like, they kind of decided that let's back down basically from a larger perspective. I really don't think so. It's anything driven by electoral consideration. I could be wrong, but this is my sense, I guess.
I think this tactical retreat will only know in the long run whether this is paid off or not. So let's wait and watch, and let's see what the ramifications are. Moving on. So there was a controversy for the comedian Veer Das, who made some polarizing remarks. The video from his recent performance in the US went viral on social media. He spoke in front of a packed audience at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. He said that he comes from two Indias, one where Indian men worship women during the day and another one where they gang rape women at night. I think this one, the whole monologue was quite insulting to India. And some others said that Veer Das was only speaking the truth. So, Abhishek, what are your thoughts on this?
So, I mean, I'm not... I didn't really see the video, but I did get to hear those whatever 30-40 seconds of the clip. And I think, I mean, he has his rights to say whatever he wants. I suppose I support him on that. I am not really someone who will say that this guy should be arrested or anything like that. So that's a total sort of misdirection. I think comedy generally is going to be offensive. That's a fact around the world. The idea is that these remarks are supposed to sting quote-unquote nationalist folks, right? So those of us who love the country are going to get offended by it. Now, his whole point is that the reaction to that is actually only adding to his mileage, right? So that is exactly what is targeted by such remarks, right? To trigger folks and get them to react, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that, look, these are intolerant people. They can't take a joke. They can't digest the truth and so on. So, yeah, I think keeping the outrage to TV studios and columns is fair enough. But going around looking for his arrest or threatening violence, which is only going to add to folks, more folks wanting to do this, because that's their gateway to fame and more reward and recognition in the West, right? Because I think it was Great Pong, right? The Arnab Ray on Twitter, who said that there is a very good market for diverse comedians with undiverse views in the US, right? So if your views are aligned to the Western, the US establishment, but you're coming from a non-Western background, you're the perfect fit for them, right, in that market, which is how Veer Das and some others are.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No. My only perspective on this is that there are two aspects to it. One aspect where people say that he's earning mileage because people are outraging him, which is a very typical argument that don't give them the publicity. They are basically publicity hungry. And my personal sense is that these quote-unquote comedian celebrities are created, orchestrated as a part of a certain narrative. I just saw some of his clippings. He's terribly unfunny. Let's not even get into the matter of whether he's his competence. Okay, that can be a matter of perception between, you know, somebody might genuinely believe he's good. The fact is that, you know, it seems that he already has a Netflix show. He kind of goes and performs already in the US. So which means that he's already picked as a winner and promoted. Okay, it's not that, say, somebody in Indore, just because he's getting offended and filing a case, this guy is going to die on the publicity. He's already been catapulted to a certain role. And this outrage is not coordinated. Individual people get triggered based on what they feel is good or bad. And according to me, the greatest disappointment in this entire episode is, I mean, and also I just need to make it clear that broadly I think it's very silly. You know, use laws to silence. The question always arises why that laws are there, actually. That we had 60 years of multiple parties ruling the country, nobody has removed it. So as long as the laws are there in the book, people are going to use it. So, you know, I'm completely against frivolous cases. But one thing which kind of, you know, surprises me is, based on some of the videos that surfaced, not related to the show, but some of his previous shows and all that, he seems like quite a, his entire quote-unquote humor, comedy, seems to be highly, you know, I'm not trying to be any aesthetic police or taste kind of a person, but it's perverted. It's basically, you know, very vulgar and sexual in nature, targeting female anatomy and very crude jokes, you know, that even in a Western society, I don't think so. There are some very clear, do's and don'ts in public space, okay, which if you violate, you're going to be either ostracized or you'll be criticized. So in this entire thing, what is happening is that all these feminists, all these Lutyens journalists, they seem to be just happy that, you know, he kind of reflects their, there is a convergence between their political antipathy to the current government and what he has stated in US. So they gave a complete free pass for all this aversion and, you know, almost bordering on psychopathic behavior, which is like very surprising, you know. Like, you know, I've seen people being put up or ostracized or even, you know, completely shunned from public stage for much, much less. Okay, so this entire hypocrisy of, you know, just because a certain political narrative that he peddles suits the opinion maker worldview, there is a convergence. I think they just get free pass in the name of comedy, which is like extremely. In fact, I think Mahua Mitra, in a typical, whatever way you call that, she came and expressed solidarity and then very, very, perverted videos of his comedy on Mamata Banerjee emerged, okay? That was not comedy by any stretch of imagination. I'm sure if it was not Veer Das, like anybody with a different political sensibility or even any other comedian would have tracked it. I think like TMC stormtroopers would have been there to file hundreds of cases, okay? So he's just getting a free pass because he's seen as anti-Modi or whatever he spewed at New York fits their narrative. This entire, basically, I think like, I think all of, I don't want to be too judgmental about people getting triggered, you know, if they're getting triggered, they're getting triggered and they're outraging. I don't think so. It is essentially helping him because he's already there. He might get even more shows or he might get more, global stage. I think he's backed. I also think that he's backed by a global PR agency. Okay. So I think like his utility is not a function of his talent. His utility is driven by some other some other factors. Okay. So it's okay. And as long as they don't do what they did to that Farooqi, I think like that like where you go and attack the show and, basically ensure that he doesn't perform anything, that's completely illegal. But I mean, if there are some grounds on which people want to file a case against him, you know, if India doesn't have the guts to ensure free speech and state can't have the capacity to enforce civil behavior, and state also uses all these silly laws to clamp down on people, I think like if any particular individual wants to use the same laws to file it, I think tough luck, you know, that's the way it is right now. So I think as people who are genuinely committed to free speech, I think people should work towards removing these laws, okay? So this community cheering when people who are opposed to you are, facing the heat of the law while, you know, being free speech fundamentalist when, your own folks are in trouble. I think that has been the case as far as the last 20 decades in India. And I don't see that changing. I was hoping that this government might probably look at scrapping some of this frivolous grounds on which do that. And even from a societal perspective, you know, like India would get immensely benefited from free speech, you know. I mean, that's a different discussion. That's the bottom line.
Absolutely, you hit the nail on the head that he's not really funny. To be fair, I think humor or like, laughter is spontaneous and applause is planned. So I think what he's focusing on is like getting applause from like one section, which has a certain set of political views. And it's very easy. It's not very funny, but it's easy to pull someone down, like either Mayawati or Mamata Banerjee or the Indian government or Indian society. But it's very difficult to actually generate humor, like the good old fashioned humor.
These guys go for the low hanging fruits, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And, yeah.
So I think we've given him too much mileage, as like that part, I agree with Abhishek that the fact that we are discussing it is part of his agenda has
he's going to be getting the megaphone, to wield the megaphone, irrespective of whether we are discussing him or not. Actually, that is my point.
No, but what happens is so one thing is so there is this comedy skit that is then well publicized in the media, but then the next phase is publicized even more that India is intolerant. So that is, no, I guess, I mean, it's bound to happen, but no, I think that's on the reaction.
That's a very, according to me, that's a little bit of a defensive thing. Ultimately, it's about the contestation of idea. You know, he puts out all that, people search his old videos of all his perversion.
Yeah, so that is true in the sense, more and more people now know about his past material also, which is not very flattering.
It's also contestation, yeah. Right? Like, only problem, like, ultimately in India, some people take law into their own hands or file cases.
Correct.
Which is a different issue, according to me. But otherwise, I think, like, you know, it should be no holds barred contestation in the public square.
So, moving on, that has been, like, quite a controversial week. So next week we have something less controversial. So View from the Inside, featuring Ashish Chandorkar. He's a counselor at the Permanent Mission for India to the WTO. He talks about his experience working inside the government in Geneva and helping India for its trade and setting up free trade agreements with other countries. We also have, which will be coming up, episode shot during the last week, was the episode with Vaibhav Chaturvedi from the Council on Energy, Environment and Water. He talks about COP26, India's mission for net zero by 2070, as well as the steps in between. And I found that episode, I was host for the episode, and very interesting, where he kind of distinguishes between pollution, which is local, but climate change, which is global. He talks about the stock effect of like all the CO2 which is already in the atmosphere versus flow effect, which is currently Asian countries which are contributing more on a net flow basis, but on the stock basis it's more the Western and European nations, and comparing like the energy mix or the CO2 emission mix of India versus the developed countries. So it was very interesting. It's definitely worth a watch. That's it from us this week. Stay safe and see you all next week. Jai Hind.
Thanks.